This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last year, the Vermont Bar Foundation commissioned a study to look at the impact of providing legal services for low-income Vermonters. The Vermont Access to Justice Coalition was charged with figuring out what that value is and how to quantify it. The Access to Justice Coalition is a group that's been around for about 15 years now, and it's charged with finding solutions to unmet legal needs in the state. It's made up of members of the Vermont Supreme Court, the Vermont Bar Association, Vermont Legal Aid, Legal Services of Vermont, Vermont Law School, and the Vermont Bar Foundation. The report on low-income legal services comes out today. The headline is that the group found that every dollar spent on low-income legal services puts $11 back into the Vermont economy. But we're going to get deeper into that report today on Vermont Edition, as well as get a better understanding of where there is still unmet need. Joining us for the conversation are two members of the Access to Justice Coalition. Daniel Richardson is a partner at Tarrant, Gillis, Merriman & Richardson in Montpelier. He's the past president of the Vermont Bar Association and the Vermont Bar Foundation. David Kenninger is deputy director of Vermont Legal Aid. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having us.
You know, we talk about access to legal services, and I'm hoping that maybe you can just clarify what that actually means, because we're talking about more than just hiring a lawyer if you're a defendant in a criminal case. So, Daniel, could you start by just telling us a little bit about, you know, what is this idea of legal services and legal services for low-income people?
Sure. Access to justice is a larger concept about getting meaningful access to the judicial system for resolving disputes or fulfilling obligations or defending rights or accessing benefits that would not otherwise be accessible to you. Legal services covers a wide waterfront of both lawyers in the private bar, lawyers in legal aid and legal services, who provide very different services. And David can certainly talk about the different types of services that they provide. But, you know, we're seeing more and more paralegals coming in and giving advice to people, for example, special education, as well as child support hearings. What it is we're trying to create a network of meaningful professionals that can provide support and resources and advice and guidance for navigating the legal system, because it's not self-evident and it's not something that you want to do by yourself. It's make the metaphor, it's akin to doing surgery on yourself. Maybe you'll get lucky and take out your appendix, or maybe you'll kill yourself.
that's quite stark. I mean, but you know, I think sometimes when people hear, you know, that you're thinking about access to legal services for low-income people, you know, in my head runs that line that you hear in so many movies and so many police procedurals, like, if you cannot afford a lawyer, one will be provided to you at no cost to you. That is only in certain circumstances, and there are a lot of other ways that people might need a lawyer or might need representation or might need some kind of advice.
Absolutely. The right to counsel is actually very limited. It's limited to largely felony criminal procedures, charges, as well as certain rights. For example, termination of parental rights, you're entitled to an attorney. Otherwise, you're on your own, and especially in a lot of civil legal issues. So, for example, debt collection, eviction, at trying to access Social Security benefits, there's no inherent right to a lawyer. There's no inherent right to a lawyer if you're going to be subject to a guardianship. There is a requirement that a lawyer be appointed, but there's no system in place to provide that lawyer for you. So, you know, it's that police procedural is somewhat misleading, because it's a very narrow area in which the lawyers are appointed. And this is what's often called civil Gideon, this idea that legal representation should be broader and we should be providing it in more cases and instances.
David, can you talk a little bit about what access to legal services might look like depending on what income level or sort of social class strata you're in, how that might affect different kinds of people differently?
Well, sure. I mean, I think, you know, there's sort of a problem in the legal system as a whole, that it's very difficult for people to afford lawyers. That, you know, if you're in the middle class, it's a stretch to afford a lawyer. And you know, if you're a low income person, then you're, you know, more likely than not going to be going without a lawyer unless you're able to contact legal services. And that's where we step in, because, you know, if someone's rights are threatened, their shelter, their job, their health or well-being, you know, we can make legal services available that that can help them. You know, that we have to provide, you know, I can talk a little bit about, you know, what the need is and how many people contact us for
yeah,
services.
That would be helpful. Yeah,
sure. I mean, you know, each about 10 years ago, we were getting about 8,000 calls for services. And now when you take into account all of the partners in the Access to Justice Coalition, that number looks more like 25,000 people
per year that
need services. So there's 15,000 telephone requests for services at Legal Services Vermont. They get another 2,000 requests online. Just to pull out one statistic about a particular kind of case, there's something like more than 1,500 Vermonters each year calling looking for legal assistance with a housing problem. And so those are folks who are facing imminent homelessness, and they can't afford to hire a lawyer.
And presumably there are many other people who don't call, who either they would benefit from a lawyer, but it hasn't reached a crisis point, or they figure, I'm not going to be able to afford this. I'm not even going to bother. I'm just either going to deal with it or you know, whatever happens, happens.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the statistics show that in lots of cases, you know, in eviction court, in debt collection cases, in foreclosures, most of the people are unrepresented. And in a lot of instances, they don't even show up to court.
I can even add on that the Vermont Supreme Court has kept statistics, and approximately 80% of cases have one or more self-represented litigants.
80%?
80%. Now, that takes a lot of family court cases where you might have mother and father representing themselves in the post-divorce disputes, but it's still a stark and startling number. And when you drill down deeper into that, there's a lot of specific dockets where people, because they lack the resources or connections to find help, go on their own. Or, you know, they have the ostrich approach, which is bury their head in the sand and wait until the judgments pile up. And you see that in the foreclosure docket, you see that in the landlord-tenant docket, and you see that in a debt collection docket.
Is the problem that people need more affordable and accessible access to legal services and specifically to lawyers? Or is the problem that too much is being put into the legal system and into the court system that maybe doesn't have to, that maybe there wouldn't need to be 80% of cases because some of those cases don't actually need to be going through that system?
I'll cut it this first. The answer to the second part is no. I mean, we're often talking about very fundamental rights that are being adjudicated, and you need a court to sit there. You know, when you talk about foreclosure, you're talking about foreclosing somebody's right to occupy and own their home in favor of a creditor, and that needs a judge. What I think we're seeing is that you know, legal services, and I'm in the private bar. You know, we struggle to provide cost-effective legal services. The cost is just simply going up. And it's not just in Vermont. It's in all states. There's just this growing need and growing backlog of these issues. And part of it is that, you know, funding has been for some of these legal aid and civil legal service partners have been flat for a number of years, and the demand has grown because the population has grown. Some of the issues have grown more complex. You know, we saw the foreclosure docket explode with the last recession, and it's just now ebbing back to where it was before. But, you know, in between, that was thousands of people caught up in this, and these were essential parts of their lives.
David, I want to come to you, but Dan, before I do, you just sure. mentioned that costs keep going up, and I want to break that down because – you know, is it costs that are going up, or is it the price of the lawyer? I mean, if a lawyer is charging you $400, maybe more dollars an hour, is that because that's what the legal services are costing, or that's just, you know, that's the that lawyers are expensive?
I can tell you, I'd love to charge $400 an hour. I don't.
But some do. I mean, that's not unreasonable.
Some do, but that's largely in professional cases where you have a business that can afford that. Part of it is that it's expensive. I mean, I can tell you that there are very few wealthy lawyers in Vermont. Most of us are middle class. And the joke is that very few of us could afford our own services because we don't make exceptionally large pots of money. You know, the practice of the law, and I've been doing it for, you know, for 17 years, has become more expensive over time. Malpractice insurance, you know, legal research tools, just the demands of a case can be substantial with discovery and electronic discovery. I mean, we've garnered more information in the electronic age, which means more work for lawyers. You know, as opposed to having five documents on paper that you have to preserve, you now have every email that you ever sent in a case that you have to review. And that adds up to expenses, and it makes it more complicated.
David, when we think about who then has access and you know, you're deputy director of Vermont Legal Aid, which really focuses on helping low-income people have access. Dan was just mentioning, you know, many middle-class lawyers even say they couldn't afford themselves. Is it the middle class that winds up not having access to these services because they can't afford them and they don't have any sort of assistance? Or is it really stratified so that lower income people are really suffering more when it comes to access?
Well, I think it's lower income people in the sense that they're more likely to have more significant legal needs. For example, if you recall Matthew Desmond's book about eviction, you know, he makes the point that eviction, you know, sort of is an accelerant to poverty. You're evicted once and that throws everything out of whack. And then you're scrambling to do a whole bunch of other things. And, you know, you folks just had the set of stories about, you know, life in Vermont and how, you know, very few people can afford to, you know, pay a $1,000 bill if they get it.
Well, right. 40% of people said they would not be able to cover an unexpected $1,000 expense.
And that's what's happening to our clients. They have something happen. You know, we have someone who, you know, is injured at work and can't work for a few months. And they get behind on their credit card bills. And then they get sued for collection. And they get sued by a big bank from out of state. And, you know, they can't even tell whether the amount that the bank is asserts that they owe is really, you know, the correct amount. And so, you know, they need a lawyer to go in there and say, hey, wait, you know, this is how you have to prove up that case. And, you know, I think that, you know, that given the situation that, you know, that most low-income Vermonters are in, they're in a very tenuous state. They walk a very fine line, and it takes very little to throw that off. And when it does, that's, you know, when the need for civil legal assistance really kicks in.
We're talking today about access to legal services and what that means and how can people get it. And we're also talking about a report that came out today that looks at the impact on the economy of when people do have access to legal services. This group is making the argument that access to legal services for every $1 that's put in to helping somebody have that kind of legal representation or help, that $11 come back to the Vermont economy. If you have a question about this or maybe an experience that you think would help illuminate the conversation, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your comments or questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. Barbara writes in to say, a concerted effort to provide legal advice and representation, and even mediation, could help a lot with our high eviction and homeless rates. We need to look further upstream of eviction and concentrate on prevention. So, Dan and David, we've kind of established what the issue is here. And then your organization and your coalition, the Access to Justice Coalition, has come out with this new report. It's actually being released formally at 2 p.m. today. And what you're saying is that there is a benefit not just to the people who have this legal representation and access to legal services, but a benefit to the entire Vermont economy for people to have this access. So, Dan, make the case for why. And I mean, that's such a big number.
Sure.
For every dollar spent, $11 comes back to the economy?
Well, it is a large number, and it does put us, you know, these studies have been done in other states. It puts us at the front of that line. We're comparable to a state like North Carolina that has a 10-to-1 ratio, or Tennessee, which also has an 11-to-1 ratio. But we certainly are ahead of states like New York, Ohio, or Texas that have much smaller ratios. Part of that is because, you know, we're dealing in smaller numbers, and there's a lot – well, let me take a step back. First of all, we have a network and a web of legal service providers that are represented by the coalition. And I have to say that it's really wonderful the way we all work together. There's very little drama. There's very little stepping on toes in jurisdiction. It's a collaboration.
Nobody's saying, I object.
Exactly. I mean, there are no drama queens. So as a result, we cover a wide variety of bases very efficiently. But what causes this, I think, is that, we can have a huge impact in Vermont on getting a lot of these services with very little investment because, it's a small state and we don't need a lot of people as long as we have enough to sort of go out there and make these arguments. And, these income results are what I call domino results, which is, we're upstream of all the problems that you hear from the criminal justice system and the juvenile docket. These are before these things happen. And by having these steps, by keeping a family in a home, or at least if they're being evicted, establishing enough process to get a delay so that they can find other housing keeps them stable. And as a result, they don't go on, state services. They don't go into a homeless shelter. They don't lose their job. They keep, producing and supporting themselves, or it's unlocking benefits such as Social Security or Social Security disability or Medicare and Medicaid. And that's all federal money that comes into the state. And, as you drill down into the report, there's about $32.7 million in 2017 that the legal service providers were able to get as direct income to their clients. And that's really an amazing number. There's obviously states that have larger populations with larger numbers, but, per person, that's a significant number, and that's income that they would not have had, that we as taxpayers in the state would have had to subsidize because this went to essentials for life.
Yeah, you look at the stats that you have in this report, and you say of those $32.7 million that of income that was secured for clients, the Social Security, supplemental security income, and Social Security disability income make up a big chunk of that, about $10 million that was able to come to Vermont residents because of their access to legal services. Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements, $17.4 million. And then some of the other ones, child support, a little over $4 million. Now, child support may have been in the state already, but it's going where it's legally supposed to go. Veterans and other benefits, almost $500,000. Increased wages for immigrants receiving work authorization, about $500,000. David, was there a necessity to break this all down and quantify the benefits rather than just saying this is a benefit to the greater good because there's some defense that needs to be made or some desire for increased spending?
Well, I mean, it's helpful to to have the report put it out there in this way, but I did want to make a couple of points about that. I mean, one is that, for example, the people who did the report couldn't look at everything, so they didn't look at the value of food stamp cases because they didn't have a metric to measure that. So for
why not?
The folks doing the report didn't have a metric to figure out how to value the receipt of the food stamp benefits, but that's clearly something that feeds back into the economy. We know the food stamp program originates in the Department of Agriculture. Why? Because they know that if people are buying food, they're helping the farmers. So there's that kind of benefit. But you're absolutely right in mentioning that there are other aspects too. I mean, we absolutely think that this shows something we said all along. It's a good investment, and I can talk a little bit more about some of the upstream things we're trying to do as well. But there's also the sense in which this is just the right thing to do. The report couldn't really look at the value of getting special education services for a child who needs those services to succeed in school, and what's going to happen when that child does succeed in school and can move forward and become have a productive life, where they've got a job and they're a contributing member of society, rather than being in the school to prison pipeline. They didn't look at the value of getting a reasonable accommodation for someone in housing or in the workplace. There's no way to sort of measure the value of the individual rights work we make. Dan was talking about if there's an attempt to be an involuntary guardianship, the work to represent that person to maintain their independent living status, or the work that we do for folks who are faced with being committed to mental health treatment or involuntary medication. So all those things, it's very you can't really put a number on those things, but we've always believed that there was a value to our services that it paid off in the community. And to try to tie this together with the commenter that one of the things we've been looking at is trying to be more upstream. In our eviction work, our housing work, by representing tenants or working with tenants at the rent escrow hearing stage of the eviction proceedings, so that if there's a possibility to connect the tenant with some resources in the community so they can pay their back rent, most evictions are a result of unpaid rent. Can we, get them connected with enough money to keep them in the housing so that they're not dislocated, the landlord gets paid, and the tenancy moves forward without all the dislocation and the things that result from the eviction.
Right, so that the legal services aren't rendered at the very end of the process, but beforehand.
Exactly. And Another project that we've been working on recently is working with folks who are in recovery or getting services from the recovery service providers but have legal needs. They might need an expungement so that they can get into subsidized housing or so that they can finally get a job. And by doing that, we can help them be more stable and make the chances of recovery being successful much higher.
Daniel Richardson is a partner at Tarrant, Gillis, Merriman, and Richardson in Montpelier. He's the past president of the Vermont Bar Association and the Vermont Bar Foundation. David Kenninger is deputy director of Vermont Legal Aid. They both serve on the Vermont Access to Justice Coalition, which just released a report on the benefits of providing access to legal services for people who otherwise couldn't get it. We're talking about their report today and why they think it's a benefit to the state economy to make sure people get lawyers and legal services when they need them. So we've been talking a little bit about this idea, this sort of overarching idea of how much is infused into the Vermont economy when people have access to legal services. And sometimes that's income that they are getting themselves, obviously, but then that goes back into things that they can purchase, housing that they can have, an ability to live a life where you're also spending the money that is, your entitlement in the Vermont economy. And some of that could have been perhaps known before, but maybe not quantified as it is in this report. Dan, I'm wondering, what was the professed need for having this report in the first place and for quantifying it? You mentioned other states have already done it, but Vermont hadn't.
Well, I think in part to justify, a lot of the funding of legal aid and legal services of Vermont come from state and federal grants that are given each year. And I think legislators are more keenly aware of what type of investment return they get for these type of grants. So this is a really important report. It's the first of its kind in Vermont, I should add, to understand what is this work doing. I mean, I think there's a moral component to this work that, we help the least of us. But there has to be a good investment on a business sense to continue to do it and to continue to, expand it as the population requires. And this report really puts that out there to show that, helping people at these points in their lives does not just good for these individuals, but it does good for the greater society because it ensures that they have income, it ensures that they have resources, and that that we as the larger taxpayer base aren't necessarily subsidizing this as we might have to if these services weren't in place.
David, what's the ultimate goal, though? Is the idea to put yourself out of business? I mean, should there be some kind of permanent or and bigger sense of community investment in access to legal services so any of us who need legal services could get it at any point? And there's no need for, for you to come in and be sort of activists for people who otherwise can't get legal services?
Well, I think we would all love to put ourselves out of business, to never have anyone with a significant civil legal need that's unrepresented or that they can't manage on their own. But I like to think of our work as really public health work, so that when you're helping someone have access to three squares, they're going to get enough nutrition. You help them get out of unhealthy housing. You help someone escape a situation of domestic violence. You help someone get access to Medicaid or health insurance so that they can actually access the health care that they need. All of those things are really an aspect of public health. And I think one of the things that that we ought to consider is that as we decide sort of both at the state level for sure and nationally, that we want there to be much more government and community involvement in making sure everyone has access to health care, we have to realize that one way to make people healthy is to make them not be poor. And, poor people have a variety of health-harming legal needs, again, ranging from housing to family violence to access to adequate food and warmth in the winter and so on. And I think that, if you can conceptualize the benefit in that way, the benefit of our work in that way, it helps to understand why it's so critical.
But boiled down, what would the argument be? Listen, folks, you're going to need to pay more in taxes to fund legal services because ultimately it will save you money?
I think that's exactly the argument.
Yeah.
These are domino services that stop other things from happening. If you talk to the criminal justice system, and I was actually at a legislator's day with the Washington County State's Attorney, and they were talking about the juvenile docket and the immense amount of strain that juvenile docket is facing all throughout the state. That's expensive. That's expensive on all levels. If you can keep people out of those situations, if you can take a few dollars and stop them from going down that path by keeping them in stable housing or providing a source of income that they're entitled to, that has a major effect that ripples down, that avoids those larger expenses. And I think that's the short of it, is that we're in providing these services at a critical point where it's more cost effective, less costly to keep somebody in a house during a foreclosure than to deal with the after effects after they become homeless, after they become either victims of crime or perpetrators of crime or subject to some addiction.
It's interesting because, Dan, I asked you toward the beginning of the show, is it that there's too much going into the legal system? And you said no. But it sounds like what you're advocating for is a shift, and that the end result of people not having access to legal services, and whether it's legal services that allow them to stay healthy or legal services that allow them to avoid the criminal justice system or whatever it is, that if they can have those services early, which are still legal services, then it might actually relieve some pressure on the court system and on those dockets. And so it's not that we need less involvement. In fact, it might be more involvement, but earlier, which will avoid the sort of really intense and problematic and life-changing involvement later down the line.
That's absolutely right. And it's interesting because, I think that's where a lot of legal services are going. If you look at the criminal docket, drug court has become much more popular. And that's an interventionist court that tries to get people, less about sentencing and punitive measures and more about a recovery and a therapeutic process. We often in the legal profession compare ourselves to the medical profession, and I think exactly what we're advocating are kind of those preventative measures, like good diet and good health. My wife is a nutritionist and she really emphasizes that, and I think this is the same kind of thing. And it's also interesting, if you read the short stories of William Carlos Williams.
That is not where I thought we'd be going in this program.
I didn't think so. But you look at him and he's dunning his clients. He's providing these private services and, he sees the need. If a doctor reads that today, it's a completely different world. They live in a world where there is universal access to health care. There is, insurance, and there is this right to health care concept that at least, people are advocating for. And that's in some ways where the legal profession is going. I mean, I find more in common with William Carlos Williams' stories than I think a doctor would today. Part of this may be a shift and a change to that, to say we're going to be a better society if we can have people that are vulnerable and in these positions have access to these legal services, these civil legal services at the beginning.
David, you want to jump in on that?
Well, I think that's exactly right. That the notion of sort of harm reduction, can we get in early on? We put out a report last year called Eviction in Vermont that talked about the ability of folks to intervene in the eviction process sooner rather than later could both and particularly with funds simply to pay rental arrearages could significantly reduce the eviction court docket and would have the benefit of keeping people in stable housing for for a longer period of time. And so, you know, again, that is the kind of intervention where if you can get in at the right time, you know, you're reducing the harm and you're also, you know, reducing the strain on the court system. So
when you did this report and the report is coming out today that shows that for every dollar put into helping people access legal services, $11 go into the Vermont economy. And you quantify that by saying that 2017 estimated impact of civil legal services was $66.4 million. And that's an $11 return for every dollar in funding. Those are concrete numbers based on an actual amount that and there's there are interesting ways that this has been calculated in the report that I don't think we have a ton of time to go into. But you're calculating the amount of dollars saved or put back into the economy in 2017. So those are only dollars that went to legal services that were rendered, not to people who didn't get legal services. You're not estimating what the return would have been if everybody who needed legal services got them. So if we know that $66.4 million has sort of been infused into the Vermont economy because of this, how much could there have been? Or where are the unmet needs that need to be addressed that you're hoping this report will help maybe spur action on? David?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we only represent, you know, a fraction of the people that call us. You know, I think I cited earlier the 1,500 folks with eviction issues. We're probably handling only a few hundred of those cases. You know, we are, you know, giving people advice and helping some folks represent themselves. But, you know, being able to be more actively involved or you know, another example would be to having a funding to do rent escrow clinics around the state or to do family law clinics around the state to help more people understand, you know, the whole family court process. All of those kinds of things, you know, could create, you know, additional value and would help people you know, meet the need that's out there.
Dan, what would you like to see? I mean, do you want to see some action in the legislature? I mean, legislatures love reports.
They do. And yes, I think part of what this – there's a number of things that we're going to do with this report. One of them, the Access to Justice Coalition will be making a unified request to the legislature on a number of issues. And I can point to two I think that are really critical. One I mentioned before – adult involuntary guardianships are rising at a very high rate as our population ages. And this is where mom or dad is facing dementia, can't handle their own finances or medical care. By law, we're required to have an attorney representing that person at the hearing. And oftentimes that's the only attorney in the room because the children are doing this on their own. They don't have money to hire an attorney to help them with the guardianship. That is currently unfunded. It's an unfunded mandate. And that's a really important, and it's going to be a growing thing. And the other is in termination of parental rights. One of the important issues, and it often is a time hang up when you're trying to finalize these things, is for the adoptive parents to form an agreement with the parents losing custody for visitation post-adoption. And those parents don't have legal representation. And in some ways, they're the only people that don't have legal representation, and they need it as well. And I know that the Bar Association has tried to address both of those. But, you know, they're both things that if there was funding, there would be better outcomes, quicker outcomes, and better process.
So is some of it funding and some of it actual reform and regulation reform?
There's not so much regulation reform. I mean, I think what we're always trying to do is find new creative solutions, you know, better access to the courts. And that's why I say access to justice is a huge topic unto itself, which when you have a 2-hour Vermont edition, we can come back for. But it is, you know, it's looking at greater technology. It's looking at these issues where, you know, this is where the money is coming in. And this is where funding should be coming and increasing.
We got a note from a listener who says small claims court is meant to be a court where someone who cannot afford an attorney has the opportunity to receive justice. However, the court charges a high fee for accessing a transcript and a recording of the proceedings. If you can't afford the transcript and your wealthier opponent in the court case can, you're at a huge disadvantage in an appeal procedure. In all fairness, a low-income person should have access to transcripts at little or no cost. David, is that the kind of thing that you hope is actually talked about or that this report will spur spur that kind of conversation that this listener writes about?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, within the whole constellation of access to justice, you know, small claims court reform is definitely, you know, something that we need to talk about. And you know, a variety of proposals can be made about how to make things better. It's certainly true that, you know, if you go to small claims court without an attorney and there's an attorney on the other side, you're going to be at a significant disadvantage, even though the small claims court is intended to be for individuals to represent themselves.
Well, there's a lot to discuss and a lot maybe to come out of this. So we'll keep an eye on what happens from this report. Daniel Richardson is a partner at Tarrant, Gillis, Merriman and Richardson in Montpelier. David Kenninger is deputy director of Vermont Legal Aid. They both serve on the Vermont Access to Justice Coalition, which is releasing a report on the benefits of providing access to legal services for people who otherwise couldn't get it today. Thank you both very much for being on the program today. I appreciate your time.